Blog Talk Radio. Converging Flow. You're listening to a bit of Thunderbeat. This is from her Ancient Sun CD called Golden Sun. And I'm your host, Michelle Mache, fellow traveler upon the path. It's wonderful to be here. Awakenings is an interactive live internet radio show that focuses on grounding the spiritual process of awakening. Welcome in love and light. How is everyone doing out there? I see some people that have been emailing me. There was a little mix-up on time zone, but all is in a perfect flow, and the chat should be coming available. I have it up myself, so it should be available for the listeners that I'm seeing already coming in the comment stream. So great to connect with everyone. Yep, chat is open, everyone. I see people coming in, so if you're listening. By the way, those that are listening by phone or mobile phone in the car, I had a couple people email me that they were going to be listening by phone. If you'd like to call in with questions, you can call in at 310-539-5122. We love the feedback, love the questions, love the comments. And, of course, as you all know, Awakenings is... it's a place for all of you. It's you all are making Awakenings what it is. It's not just the guests. It's not just me. It's all of us together. And those of you that have been following me on Twitter, you can connect at Awakenings tweet. And in fact, I'm going to send out a little tweet in a little bit, letting everyone know that the show has started. And a lot of people have been listening from there. And those that have been listening from other podcast stations, Cosmic Dimensions and iTunes, I welcome all of you to this place and space that we're calling Awakenings. Really important time that we're in right now. Wonderful evolution that we're all participating in. And we're the participants, and we're being participated upon. How's that? We're co-creating it, we're facilitating it, and we're a part of it, and it seems to be happening to us, yet on some level we are part of this great unfolding and co-creating this great unfolding as well. So it's wonderful times, and it's great to be able to come together with like-minded individuals, if we will, per that law of resonance. We don't have to always agree, but there's enough of a resonance there that it's valued insider information. It's a valued sharing. And that's really important at this time, that we hear from people all over the globe that are walking the same path in a different way, a similar way. But to hear from them, their unique individual experience and expression, very important. Because what I find is it adds pieces. It adds new pieces that I may not have known, or maybe looking at something in another way. It's actually part of that evolutionary process that's going on. That's where you become that great facilitator, right? When you're part of that evolutionary process, when you recognize that you are, when you're consciously aware that you're part of this evolutionary process, that makes, to me, life much more enriching, much more enriching experience. And that's part of what we're here to do, right, is to not only live an enriching life for ourselves, but also to assist others in doing so. And I find also that many times it not only helps others that may not perhaps have such an awareness of what is actually going on in the world or in the collective. That's that whole idea that we are the way showers, in a sense. We're holding that place with our consciousness. But also with our consciousness, that also means that we have to share our insights. There's a little bit of a revealing that takes place in regards to our path, where we're revealing what we've learned, what we've experienced. And that lets others reveal a little bit more and have a deeper understanding of what they're going through. So it's really, I think, that whole idea of authenticity, living more authentic, is really about that revealing. Not that you have to reveal everything, but in that sharing, in an authentic sharing, we learn so much, not only about the people that we're sharing with, but in actuality about ourselves. So we have on today, which we're really, I'm tickled to have back on the program, is Hank Wesselman, who really is well-versed, well-traveled in a lot of different areas of awakening or waking up from a anthropological point of view, a spiritual point of view, a cosmological point of view, if you will. He's made it his kind of life work or life mission to explore the ancient and to, in that exploration, in search of answers to the mystery of the human origins. That's been his life path and his unfolding, and it's brought him into deeper spiritual connection and understanding. In a way, you could say Hank Wesselman is a scientist and a mystic. He's bringing those two perspectives together. Many times we think these perspectives are opposing, and Hank Wesselman actually doesn't think so. He sees them as one in the same, perhaps different or complementary aspects, if you will. So without further ado, I want to see if he is on air. Hank, are you with us? Hank, are you with us? Hello, you're on Awakening. Okay, I'm not sure if that's... Hi, you're live on the air with Awakenings. Hi, you're live on the air with Awakenings. Okay, well, maybe that's... I thought that was him on the air. Let me know, too, those that are in the chat, if you can hear me. I want to make sure I have good sound, because we had some little techie issues earlier, which can sometimes happen when you're dealing with technology and things are ever shifting or expanding. That can sometimes happen. So if you can let me know in the chat if you can hear me. Sometimes that happens when we're not fully... okay, there it is. There he is. Okay, so I guess the other person is just waiting to... be on the air, just to listen, which is great. I mean, that's one great thing about Awakenings is that, or any of these internet shows, well, a lot of them anyway, I don't know if all of them, but many of them, I get these wonderful emails that people are driving cross-country or going up the coast in their car and they're listening, you know, or they didn't want to miss the show, they're on vacation and they're listening by their you know, phone because they didn't bring their computer or something. So, it's wonderful that we have this technology. It's wonderful when it works. Actually, I bless it even when it doesn't work, because you know, it's like anything else, it always takes some kind of adjustment. Okay, let's see if hi Hank, are you on the air? Hello? 510-355.
No, this is actually Amber, and I was going to say that earlier in the show you gave out the wrong calling number, I think.
No, 347-539-5122.
Okay. There was another number given out, so I thought maybe that was the problem. But I'm just listening.
Thank you. Okay, good. How are you doing, Amber?
I'm well. I can't get into the chat room today. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, but is it? You can now. Did you try now? Because I see people in there now. Yeah, there was a little technical difficulty earlier with the times, but now I do see people in there. So if you're in there, would you let me know if you can hear me? Because I put in a little that's the one thing with the guests. When guests come in as a guest, they're not able to respond in the chat. So they weren't able to respond to me that they could hear me. And I think area code, let's see, Hawaii, because Hank is calling from Hawaii, is, 805, so that lets me know that. Good. Well, welcome to the, back to the program, Amber. You're holding the light here.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's good. So how are things, what, do you have any more of your pearls of wisdom for us? It was a great show when we had Kemet Prince on.
You know, it's so funny because we actually got in contact, and I talked to him the other day.
Good.
Yes.
Oh, good.
So that was pretty interesting. You know, he's a wonderful brother. And, you know, he said something to me that I'll pass on here. He said, imagination is the highest form of intellect. And that was just, you know, that was killer for me. Just because we always seek to suppress that part of our nature, you know, not realizing whatever you imagine is what you can be. You know, if you can envision it in your mind, in the dream space, then it will take shape and form here. So, yes, I'll pass that along. Imagination is the highest form of intellect.
Yeah, I love that. You know, somewhere along the line, we've caught, you're right, we've, I say we as in the more the mainstream array of consciousness, because, you know, I call Einstein thinking. There are certain people that haven't forgotten that, but that's what our building blocks are, right, are really from the imagination.
Yeah. It's just somehow, some way, you know, people are getting the message of being, or the message is being received to suppress or deny one's imagination in one way. Even though, you're right, they are the building blocks.
Yeah, that's, not sure why that is. It's almost like, I don't know, and listeners, if anybody's heard of this book, I think it's called The TV Generation. Yeah. It came out in the late, I think early 90s, actually, and it was all about how, it wasn't all about it, but a little bit about, you know, which I love technology. I'm a bit of a mystic tech, so I really love it. But apparently, in things like reading, you actually, certain synapses are created in the brain that help you fill in imagination or create, to imagine or to image. When we think of imagination, it comes from imaging, the French word and Latin derivation of imaging. So to image, to bring into form, before you manifest, you have to image it. So apparently what starts to happen, this is so interesting, Amber, that because the children that were raised predominantly with video games and not reading, where they saw everything visual. And, of course, you remember, you know, and I love music videos, but, you know, it's the imbalance where you're getting all your information from what is already seen. Those synapses in the brain that, in other words, fill in the blank between A and C, in other words, B. So when you're reading something, your brain, there's a chemical change that happens for you to begin imagining what you're reading. You know, or those that are listening right now, you're having to imagine what, you know, maybe what we look like, what we sound, you know, what room we're in. You're imagining all these things. But when there's an overuse, an overfocus on the visual, that you don't, the synapses are not, they're not, they atrophy. They don't get replicated. And the contention of this book was saying that makes not that there's anything wrong with factory makers or service people that are just fixing or repairing something, but it's not good for honing or sparking the imagination. And you see a lot of people that have a predominant focus on the visual aspect, and they, you know, an over, it's interesting, and as you look back, it makes strengths in one area, but takes strengths away in another area, so that even having a longer focus for something, there isn't that, because there's always that immediate. You have it in the visual, you have it in the video, you have it in the game that one is playing. There's not any fitting, you're not creating what you think is happening, because someone's constantly providing that for you. So, I found that.
I said, that's true. That's true. I've noticed, you know, because I think I mean, I'm from that generation, the, you mm-hmm. know, video games and Mario, Super Mario Brothers 3 replaced books for most kids in my age group. You know, I mean, even though I still read, and I still do read now, and I, like you, love technology, you know.
I love my technology. Yeah.
Techie savvy Oracle type. Yeah.
That's right. Yay!
It's the hybrid. It's the original hybrid.
It is. Well, I think, and I was in that bridging point where we had a lot of technology was starting to come in. Was raised on music videos. That was, but we still had the reading. You know, there was still a lot with the reading.
Right.
That, you know, I don't know the answer. I just find it interesting. I find it an interesting contemplation.
What will that
do down the road? You know, what will that do actually, right, to our evolution?
That's true. No, it changes it. It alters it, just like with the advent of, you know, electricity did, you know, in different parts of the world, or the advent of the internet. And I think what it's doing, from my experience, is the part of your brain, because now that you explain it that way, that it's between synapses, that space is formed to create an imagery, the part of our brain that does that is kind of being extended. You know, it's extending
mm-hmm.
outside the head through the entire body brain and into the sort of the matrix pattern of the God mind, so that the mm-hmm. synapse jump is a little bigger and something else is forming in the imagination space. Because you're if you're looking at something all the time, it's like, you know, singing in an orchestra, or singing with, you know, you sing with one person, and that's a mm-hmm. duet, you know, harmonize, and then you sing with a trio, and that makes a whole other melody or resonance. And then you sing with 1,000 people, and that has a completely different vibration. So I think that's what's happening, is like everything else, we're speeding it up. And we're quantifying, you know, multiplying it quantumly what we can envision. And that's why it's so necessary, like you talk about all the time, the emotional clearing and being connected and grounded with the self, because this information is coming through, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's not.
Exactly. I love it. You know,
it would be
to evolve anyway. You know, it's going to happen anyway.
It's going to happen anyway.
Exactly.
You're either conscious of the happening or you are not.
That's right. I mean, you know, it kills me. Some people that a few years back that were so resistant to computer or email, you know, and now they're I had to do it. And it's like, why not? You know, I look at it as fun. Why not dive into stuff that's new? What is this thing like, you know, having to hold on to something that's, you know, I don't even know what they're holding on to, actually. The resistance
to the old form.
Yeah.
The old regimen, you know. It's like, you know, with living in this Aquarian age, the age of knowing, we're getting further and further away from the teacher-student dichotomy and into the realm of masters. We're entering the realm of masters. And most people, most of us, me included, I've got to catch myself at times too, we thrive on waiting to be told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's one thing to have dialogue. That's something completely different, you know, and to be open and receptive to knowing something that you don't know. But to sit there and not even engage your mind or your heart or your spirit like we've been conditioned to do and sit and wait to be told, we're moving out of that.
Out of that, yeah. And that's where that intuition comes in. You know, and I got to share something with you and everyone else that's listening because this is so apropos. And this is why some levels I love the it's kind of a how do I want to say it's oxymoronic how, if that's even a word I'm making it up now oxymoronic because you know I have as a mystic and as a psychic and a channel you know and working with the soul and spiritual that kind of background and then I have the it's not even traditional therapy but it still is a therapeutic background of counseling. And I was working with someone, and I rest in the center of the two, and I laugh at it all because I had a wonderful client, and it was because you also brought up Amber, the emotional work, the emotional clearing. It was a channeling session, and she won it, and we happened to be working with the Oversouls and also her personal guides, and a lot of what was being said was already unfolding, so there was a lot of confirmation for her. But she said, well, what should I do? Because it sounds like what I'm going to do, it was going to be a little messy. I said, well, you're going to be on a razor's edge. So I leaned back in my chair. Now, mind you, this is my phone, but I leaned back in my chair, and I started I said, this is why I love what I do. I said, because in the land of spirit, in the land of the soul, there is no wrong or right. There's just experience. And your higher self, whatever pickle we think we get ourselves in, your higher self is going to create something out of that to get you to the next level of unfoldment and the next level, the next level. Now, you could lean back as a therapist, you know, and a transperson in the transpersonal psychology, if you want to raise your vibrational frequency, there's certain things you want to perhaps outgrow or evolve out of. So perhaps something that isn't what we might call healthy or balanced on an emotional level, a mental emotional level, you know, for living in the earth plane. You know what I'm saying? It's two different things. And when people ask me this, I always say, you know what, you can't, because if you're asking something truly psychically from a soul or a spiritual level, there is no judgment of right or wrong.
That's right.
You know, there can be that which is more life enhancing. But if you're, you know, and if you look at it, everyone looks back at their path, you'll see choices that you made that perhaps you think weren't great or weren't evolved or just bad. Even, you know, if you want to judge them and go, oh, God, I wish I didn't do that. But then you see where it led you, that there was always something life-enhancing, creative, used by that situation to get you to that next unfolding or that next level. So anyway, Amber, when you were mentioning that, it just brought that up to me because I thought we really, you know, we have to be clear about what we're asking because if we're asking something on a mental, emotional level or what's right for me to do on that level, that's a lot different than
asking out of clarity and centeredness and within divine force in the cosmological scope. No, I agree with you. Asking for something out of the, what that popped up in my head was asking for something out of the mental and emotional body has a fear of not getting the opposite of that. So, I want this because I don't and fear that. I want this because, you know, I do. And so, it's still based on some part of the polarity of the energy.
Yes.
And I
totally understand because when I was explaining to this person, I said, we all want to come from, and we've been conditioned this, good, you know, I'm being evolved. And I said, the thing is what you're, a lot of times, and this is going to bust people's paradigms, But a lot of times your decisions on this level, it has no reflection on how evolved you are, because you're just playing out a little aspect here. Right? That's something I've
snippet. One little snippet. And our challenge is to try and elevate our interactions to a point where we can, you know, pull down and channel our highest evolutionary spirit form in the physical. That's our challenge, but you're right. Right now, we're still actually on a very, very base plane.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Again, I go back to as a channel. I've worked with people sometimes after they've, well, in the crossing, in the evolution or the process of crossing over. And sometimes I've worked with family members that they're, again, we talked about earlier, the holding on. And, oh, he wouldn't like that or she wouldn't like that. And then when you get in the channeling session and you see that, well, they don't care. Because, you know, in the crossing over, they go into that space of wholeness or oneness. They no longer are playing out certain patterns or paradigms. They're not coming from that space of, well, I didn't like, you know, so-and-so. I didn't like who you married, and I didn't like... you know, apple pie, only like peach pie. They don't care. It's not about that anymore. It's only on this level or this dimension that we live out those compliments or oppositions, you know, or likes or dislikes. It's not on the, you know, when you get beyond the polarity plane, it is just that. There is no playing that out. So I find it interesting that people, you know, and I can understand, we want to think that if someone's father, let's say, favored a sibling, a lot of times people want to think that that father, when they cross over, is still favoring that sibling. They're not. They don't care.
Nope. It's got a completely different agenda at that point, actually.
Yes.
It's not about liking you or disliking you at that point. It's all about the intention, the goal. You know, which is our evolution as a whole, as an energy. That's definitely, I can attest to that one. And, it, you know, my mother, who seemed to favor my other siblings more, just because I was the spitting image of her. I mean, we're both Virgos. You know,
but see, that's what she was working out, obviously, on this level, right? This dimension, something that she was working out.
Definitely. And it had a lot to do with healing, and more. She's come to me more in her passing than, you know, I have a deeper relationship with her now than did, or than any of my siblings ever did in life. You know, so it's interesting the way those ego walls kind of disintegrate with, you know, the inclusion of our spiritual existence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Well, wonderfully put. Yeah. It is that dissolving. And the interesting thing on living out in this realm or this dimension is that we're playing in both realms of being individuated aspects of consciousness and having the preferences or the likes and dislikes or being, you know, triggered even, you know, or being inspired or having an imagination and creating something. And then to be able to step into that allness or oneness and recognize that we're all one as we're separated out. And we're separated out as we're all one. You know, it's resting in the center of that.
Yeah.
It's in that awareness.
It's the ebb and flow and the dance instead of, because we still manifest differing parts of the spectrum. And that is the beauty index. The beauty index is that there's an unlimited expression of God. Mm. You know, across the globe, the universe, there's an unlimited expression of divinity. And as we act in it and stand upon it in all its mixtures and different hues and tones, we reflect the you know, magnanimity, if that's a word, of God.
I like it. We're making new words. We talked last time about changing language. We're here to change language. It needs to be more flowery. It needs to be more something. I don't know what.
More bigger.
Yeah, exactly. More bigger. Oh, gosh. Well, Amber, I'm going to see if our guest is on, because I tried a couple of lines. You know what also I love about technology? It's one of my biggest teachers. Mm-hmm. Having come from the TV media background, you want to do things perfectly, you know. But you know what? Things mess up in technology. And so it's a wonderful teacher of that all things are always perfect. You may not think they're ideal or you're perfection. And Tammy in the chat is putting mirrors all around. Yeah, there are all these mirrors because, you know, little things happen here and there. You know, phone lines go down. Times get put, different time zones happen, so the show is scheduled at a different time. Thank God somebody tweets you and lets you know. And you just, I just laugh. I go, okay, yes. Yes, you will not be in that little rut of perfection and think you know it all. Yes, you will get out of that.
Immediately.
Exactly. Immediately is right.
You know what I said to a friend of mine the other day, because, of course, everyone knows the Virgo and, you know, charge of being a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, perfectionism is not a stagnant state of being, but it's the dance of harmony. It's the constant movement and ability to be flexible and agile and go, oh, I want to put that over there. Oh, I want to put that over here. Oh, I want to move that. And astrologically in the zodiac, Virgo, that Virgo and when you ascertain those or put into practice those tools, those keys, it leads you into the state of harmony, which is Libra.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Oh, yeah, that's right, because it's, you know, Libra coming after Virgo. Yeah, and it's the ideal becoming more and more ideal, which I feel that is all of life. I feel like we're always becoming more and more ideal, more and more perfected, you know, more and more whole, more and more complete, more and more inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's see.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Hank, is that you?
Hey, Michelle, it's me.
Oh, great. You didn't give me a number, and I see the 111. So I introduced you before, but it wasn't you. So now it's you. So welcome.
Yes. You've got me on. I actually dialed in. I've been listening in to you guys, chatting away here. You're talking about interesting stuff.
I'm so tickled to have you back on the program, actually, in these unfolding times and talking about perfection and idealism, and which kind of ties into what I want to jump in with you about,
You're just right on the mark. I mean, we're all going in that direction. It's just a question of when we're going to get there. You know, we talked about this the last time, the fact that Jill and I were drawn into connection with a Hawaiian elder, a kohuna, named Hale Makua. And, you know, he basically said that we, you know, come into the world as gods, and then we forget. Mm-hmm. We forget who we are because this world wounds us and corrupts us. And the great goal is to rediscover ourselves as holy beings before we check out, you know, at the end of life. Because, you know, it's kind of like we're here to go to school. I mean, you guys were talking about this and the role of the oversoul, the role of the guys upstairs in sort of monitoring us and seeing how we're doing. And it's an ongoing process in which all of us are sort of learning our life lessons. And when you finally get the lesson, there are more lessons. And eventually, we will achieve a kind of perfection, if you will, and we'll bump up to the next level, whatever that next level will be. So, you know, we're all involved in it. And, you know, he was fond of saying as well, you know, if there's one thing we've got more of than anything else, it's time. So we've got all the time in the universe. And if we don't get the lessons this time around, you know, they'll just be coming back to us the next time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think? Now, Hank, looking... and I want to just tap it. Those are some people. We have more people coming in the chat right now and some other people coming online. So I just want to let everyone know that we're talking with Hank Wesselman, you have so much. I mean, anthropologist, the doctoral degree in anthropology, studied shamanism, paleontologist. You still do archaeological digs, which I love. I'd love that idea. And actually, Hank, I got to tell you, a little bit in college studied that, but boy, it's not just digging around. I mean, it's a really full science. I mean, there's a lot of information that you have to know and do.
Yeah,
I don't know how you do it all.
Too, in the last 30 years, I mean, it's really become a very hard science, you know, and computers have assisted tremendously in the analysis of large amounts of data. So, you know, it's a very exciting time to be involved in science. And hopefully with the new administration in Washington, science will be awarded the respect and the value that, you know, it used to have. So, you know, this is all good news as far as I'm concerned. You know, the work that I do, you know, I just might mention this for your listeners. Mm-hmm. The work that I do is I go out to East Africa, to Ethiopia, actually, and I work in the Rift Valley with a team of scientists, research scientists from all over the world. And we have discovered fossilized remains of an early kind of human, which is so primitive that it may, in fact, represent the famous missing link that Charles Darwin predicted we would eventually find in Africa. This thing is literally half ape, half human, and it's already made that jump towards the human direction, which means that it's the ancestor of everybody listening in on the phone today. But it's way back there. I mean, we're talking about an ancestor between 4 and 6 million years ago, and they look very, very different from what we would think of as being human today. But
What do you notice that's similar, and what is different?
Well, for starters, you know, they were upright bipedal walkers like we are, and we are the only bipedal apes, if you will. You know, when you look at the DNA resemblance between ourselves and the apes, there's so little difference that although we tend to put humans in our own human family and apes in their family, you know, there's a kind of resistance in the public at large to thinking about ourselves as related to these hairy-looking guys we see at the zoo. But in fact, we share 99% of our DNA with them. And it's that 1% which makes the difference between us and them. But this reveals that we have a very, very close relationship in an evolutionary sense with the African apes, and that we are just another very strange bipedal ape.
I can see it. I'm telling you, I don't mind being part ape or doggy animal being. I mean, it's like it's kind of, you know, I mean, just even on a precursory glance, you can see the similarities. And even the bonding, even the emotional intelligence with many of these animal beings to their young.
Oh, yes.
Very simple.
But it's important to distinguish something as well. It's really the body which is human. It isn't the soul that's human.
Right.
The soul is not human. The soul inhabits this animal body. And so while we're here in body, we have to deal with all of these less than wholesome thoughts and sort of primitive impulses. And, you know, part of our job here is to overcome these base impulses and create a receptivity to the higher frequencies of love, for example. You know, that's part of the lesson. And that's part of the soul's evolution as it travels across eternity, growing, increasing, and becoming more than it was. So it's an interesting dichotomy between the soul on the one hand and the human body, which is very distinctly animal, on the other.
That the soul is the evolution of the soul. Well, we also say the evolution of God. If we're all God and all is God consciousness, it would not be a static. It is and it isn't. I mean, it's infinite possibility and coming from this one point and expanding out, but it is ever expanding. That idea.
Have you read the works of Robert Monroe? He wrote a seminal book back in the early 1970s called Journeys Out of the Body.
Yes, in the Monroe Institute, all of the... Yes, I have.
Right. Well, you know, in his third book, which was called Ultimate Journey, it was sort of the culmination of his three books, he said something which I've never forgotten. He said that we're actually here, we actually embody, we actually incarnate to develop the ego. Now, the ego would be considered as a soul aspect by the Kahuna mystics of Polynesia.
Yeah.
They would consider us to have a physical soul, a mental soul, and a spiritual soul. And the oversoul would be equivalent to what you've been calling the spiritual soul, okay, the immortal aspect of the self. But in each lifetime, we come into a body which has this animal physical soul already in residence that we inherited from our mom and our dad, and it's associated with the physical body. And then we develop a higher frequency mental soul in response to life as we live it. And this means that all of those well-intentioned transformational speakers who say things like, you've got to get rid of your ego, or you've got to drop your ego, are absolutely on the wrong track. You know, every time I hear somebody say that, I kind of wince with embarrassment, because if they'd experienced authentic initiation and they really understood who and what they are, they wouldn't say that.
I'm so glad you're saying that, Hank. Oh, I am so absolutely glad you're saying that. And it's coming. Because anybody that, whether initiation or studying any kind of transpersonal work, you realize that the true metaphysicians know that the soul, the individuated aspect of the soul, is the ego, personality self. It's the form.
It is. It's the aspect of ourself that thinks, analyzes, integrates, makes decisions, directs. It's our inner director, the aspect of ourself that steers
us
through
this
life.
Now, because see, I thank God I didn't get this misinformation or mistraining, but there's so many books on that, and I do the same thing. I wince when I hear this. How did this happen? How did this get flip-flopped where there's this whole get rid of the ego, you can't have an ego, which is impossible if you're on this, if you're earthed, if you're born, you know?
I think it
how did that happen?
I think it happened because the ego is the aspect of the soul cluster that can lie. And so the ego, being creative, can create a false self or a false sense of self.
So they're really talking about the false ego.
That's right.
They're talking about the constructed ego or the false ego. But don't you find, two-part question. One is, don't you find that this stops people in their path trying to get rid of the ego? And also, do you find that as we've evolved in this next collective, this initiation, that we will perhaps embrace this part of us?
Absolutely, because this is the aspect of ourself that's creative. Our creative imagination is a function of the ego. That's what we're here to develop, because when we die, at the end of life, we carry these abilities into the spirit world, where they become part of the oversoul complex. And so it's in this way that the oversoul is in training, literally, to become a god, to become a creator. We have to develop this ability here on the plane of action. Yeah, the spirit world is not a level of action. It's primarily a level of information and energy. So we develop these abilities here through the challenges that we encounter in life. So, for example, the egoic self is not only our inner director, it's the source of our intentionality and our volition, much of our volition, as well as our creative imagination. And so this aspect of the self is the aspect that can become godlike in response to the choices that it makes here in the here and now. And if it makes the wrong choices, as you've pointed out, this is not a punitive system. This is not a judgmental system. If we blow it now, we're given more opportunities tomorrow. I mean, that's the way the system really works. There is no one judging us. There is no sort of alternately wrathful, alternately beneficent, godlike being sitting upstairs who has good days and bad days. You know, that's mythology that was created by our stratified state-level religions to control people. In fact, the God who listens to our prayers works in mysterious ways and sends occasional messengers to Earth who usually get treated very badly, is our own personal God self, our oversoul, the higher self that you've been talking about.
Oh, I love what you say, our own personal God self. Ooh, I love that. That's a wonderful
too.
Way to... Ooh, I love that, our own personal God self.
I like it.
Yeah, I'm hoping... this is why I get, you know, when you came on the first time, you're coming on again, and I hope you keep coming back, because to Awakenings, because this information so needs to get out there, because people are in this conundrum. They're in this, you know, cul-de-sac, round and round and round, you know, wasting time and energy and money and trying to get rid of something that is an extension of them and beating themselves up. I mean, the self-flagellation that goes into getting, you know, and I know you've seen this in workshops and stuff, the people that come to you that, oh, it just gets me, almost makes me want to cry when that are so beating themselves up because they have this ego. And they're crying literally, I can't get rid of my ego. I can't get rid. And I'm like, oh my God, please, please stop reading those books out there that you're reading, you know, that, oh. So anyway, yeah, I just feel just from the bottom of my heart, you know, that it's really time for people to be liberated and free up and stop hating parts of themselves. And the flip side of that is the information needs to get gotten out there so that people can get a hold of this and say, oh, my gosh, this is another way.
It certainly is, you know. And, you know, it's a cliche, but, you know, I think it's worthwhile to repeat it, you know. I've heard often people say that life is like photography. We develop from the negative.
Wow.
You know, it's in response to the negative experiences that we have in life. It's in response to the awareness that we have that there is darkness within each one of us. When we become aware of that darkness, we have a choice. Either we go for it and enjoy it and go along for the ride, or we make different choices. And, you know, if you look at the way society seems to be unraveling right now, as we come to the end of this cycle, it's obvious that we've made very bad choices. But, you know, it's not a punitive system, so now we have the opportunity to choose differently and to create a different set of parameters, which will essentially create a different world. And this is where I really find hope for the future. And more people are thinking and giving themselves permission to think outside of the box, to get out of that box and really consider themselves and the world they live in a completely different light. And the possibilities for advancement and stepping up are just tremendous at a time like this. I mean, I find it deeply reassuring.
You do, how everything is being dismantled or dissolved on a national, global level, or structures.
The old Black Elk, I think we talked about this the last time, but maybe we didn't. Many people have read that wonderful book, Black Elk Speaks, about the Oglala medicine man, Nicholas Black Elk, who dictated a couple
of
books.
No, we didn't,
see. Yeah, back in the 1930s, he dictated a book to an anthropologist that became an instant bestseller called Black Elk Speaks, and it's about a great vision that he had when he was a little boy. But there's also a book that he dictated before he died to another anthropologist called The Sacred Pipe. And in the beginning of that book, he repeats the legend of White Buffalo Calf Woman, who gifted the sacred prayer pipe to the people in the mythic past. At the end of that story, you know, he talks about the fact that White Buffalo Woman turned to the people before she left and she said, I will look in on you in every age, and at the end I shall return. Now, the Sioux, the Lakota, believe that there is a cycle of four ages. So do the Hindus. All right, the Hindus believe in the Yugas, the cycle of four ages. And both the Hindus and the Lakota are in agreement that we've come to the end of the last age. And it's usually at this time that everything unravels, that true spirituality becomes increasingly obscured, and the last age possibly ends with a catastrophe in which everything is destroyed. But, you know, Black Elk, in talking about this story, predicted that with the ending of this age, and we're coming to the end of that cycle right now, that the original spirituality, the true spirituality, would reemerge and reestablish itself. And he was talking about the primordial spirituality. He was talking about the shaman's path, in a way. And it would be on this foundation that the next cycle of ages would begin again. And so, you know, this is all about awakening to who we are, what we're doing here, our connection with ourselves in spirit, as well as those other transpersonal beings who are there to support us, to provide us with power, protection, and support. And those of us who walk this path are aware that there are contingencies of these transpersonal others, however you'd like to think of them. Some people think of them as angels, the angelic forces, which is just fine. You know, they're compassionate beings who are poised just on the other side of the mirror to help us through these coming times of things coming apart and then raveling back together again. So it's a very interesting time to be alive, and I'm sure that many of your listeners know exactly what I'm talking about.
Now, what do you, you know, as with your background in anthropology, how do you see this evolutionary process? Do you feel that it's something that is, as we're talking about in the yugas, the various times, that it's cyclical, or are you seeing differences by what you know from the scientific background?
Okay, here we go. If I were to turn my attention as a paleoanthropologist to these four ages, these four yugas, I would say that the first one was the longest, and it lasted from about 40,000 years ago until about 10,000 years ago. Now, 40,000 years ago, we have the appearance of anatomically and behaviorally modern Homo sapiens like ourselves. They appear on the scene, for example, in Europe. And when they appear, art appears all over the world at the same time. Now, that's very interesting, don't you think? You know, when art appears, it's not primitive. Mm-hmm. It's not stick figures. It's completely evolved art, you know, with shading, with perspective, with anatomy. It's just incredible. And, you know, this is one of the things that archaeologists puzzle over, because it's very difficult to explain why in Australia, in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, all over the world, art suddenly just appears full-blown. Now, this was the beginning of the first age, and my friend the Kahuna used to say that what happened was that there was a migration of souls that came from the stars. Us.
Mm-hmm.
That we came here as star beings from out there. And we didn't come in spaceships. We didn't come as aliens. We came as souls, as seeds of light. Mm. And we took up residence in these human bodies. We ensouled these human bodies. And we started to behave in a modern way at that time. This was the first age. And during this age, there's absolutely no question that the religious practitioner was the shaman, and religious expression was animist, the understanding that everything in existence has its own personal supernatural essence or soul. So humans have souls, plants have souls, animals have souls, rocks have souls, rivers, mountains, you know, planets, stars. They're all ensouled. This is the animist perspective.
Thank you for saying that, too. That's my experience, too, actually,
Well, this perspective is reemerging in our own time. I mean, people have written books on the new animism, which includes the awareness that this entire planet is inhabited by nations of beings, only some of which happen to be human.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to honor those nations the way we would honor other human nations as well. I mean, it's a very evolved perspective in a way. Now, at the end of this first age, everything changed. You know, there was a big meltdown of the glaciers, the megafauna, the big animals disappeared, and humans started to make their living differently. The beginnings of agriculture, the beginnings of domestication of animals and plants, the beginnings of living in settled communities. You know, up until that time, we camped out. Camped out for thousands, even millions of years before we settled into regular communities about 10,000 years ago. So the second age would be that period of time that anthropologists call the Neolithic. And it was during this time that we begin to find these figurines of pregnant women in great profusion, figurines of animals, figurines of pregnant women. And people have said, well, this is the beginning of goddess worship. And, you know, it may be, but, you know, we don't really know, because these people didn't have any written languages. But at the end of the Neolithic period, we have the appearance of the first city-states, the Sumerians, the Indus River Valley, and, of course, the next age, the third age, was that classical period determined by city-states, by the Mycenaeans, the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Babylonians, the Akkadians, the Romans, the Greeks, and so forth and so on. And interestingly, they all had a polytheistic belief system in which there were high gods and goddesses above nature for the first time. This is really where the appearance of gods and goddesses comes in, about 5,000, 6,000 years ago. And then that religious perspective predominates with the first organized priesthoods for about maybe 3,000 years. Then that age comes to an end with the collapse of the Roman Empire. And as before, a new religion appears, and that new religion was monotheism. Mm. Of course, monotheism, as everybody knows, is expressed through Islam, through Judaism, and through Christianity. These are the three primary expressions of it. And this has been the dominant religion for the 2,000-year cycle, which is now coming to an end. And as this cycle comes to an end, what's interesting to me is, just as Black Elk predicted, there is a new kind of spirituality which is appearing on the scene, a new spiritual complex, which is the harbinger, really, of a new religion which is coming in. I don't know if you saw, I think it was Newsweek, was it Time or Newsweek this week, and it talked about the decline of Christianity in America, about the fact that monotheism, as an archaic belief system, is really no longer serving us. And what we desperately need is, we need an upgrade in our perspective of ourselves, on the one hand, and our perspective of the divinity on the other. And this Old Testament wrathful God, my God is a jealous God. This guy Yahweh, when you read the Old Testament, which I have, being an anthropologist, I couldn't resist, this guy Yahweh is not somebody you want to spend time with. He's not a user-friendly guy. He's kind of like a primitive chieftain who's been aggrandized to colossal size. And this guy, is dangerous. You don't want to spend too much time around this guy. So the thought is that Yahweh really is a projection of ourselves as we perceived ourselves at that time, And now we are very different kinds of people. And so our perspective of the divinity itself is going to have to shift accordingly. And it is. It's very much in progress. And the decline, people are leaving our mainstream religions in droves. And yet it's not an atheistic movement. Quite the contrary.
It's spiritual.
It is. And people seem to be achieving a level of spiritual freedom and expression which has not been seen in the Western world for 2,000 years. So, again, this is a very exciting time.
Yeah, it reminds me, a dear client of mine who is very, very, I would say, religious Catholic, started having an amazing opening. And this reminds me what you're saying, Hank, that... she considers herself now more spiritual and more connected to God and in praying to God than when she says she was more, religious. And at first in her opening, her unfolding, she thought maybe she was being heretical or something bad was going to happen to her, from the devil. But then she kind of got over that and felt that her God, she's now understanding God, would not have had her have this opening or this awakening or becoming more aware had it been something bad. So I'm wondering if that's perhaps what will be happening in your estimation, that perhaps more of a personal relationship with God, whatever
that is for someone. This is it exactly. The experiential centerpiece at the center of this new spiritual complex, which is coming into being, reveals that each one of us can have the direct transpersonal connection with the sacred realms that defines the mystic, that defines the shaman. And, this means that each person becomes their own priest, their own priestess, their own guru, their own teacher, receiving their revelations directly from the highest sources themselves, without the need for any intermediary priesthood to stand between them and their experience of the sacred. And so this is the center of this new spiritual complex which is taking form right now. And your friend, who is still Catholic in all likelihood, has developed a more evolved perspective, a personal relationship with divinity, and that's going to serve her very well.
So that, in a sense, is where we're going. Now, a lot of people, and what I want to get your take also, many people have said that what we're going through is similar to what the Romans went through.
It's true. It's true.
Is it? Okay.
Well, look at what's happened to our, before Barack Obama was elected, I would have just come right out and said that what we have on our hands is exactly what the Romans had on their hands, a crisis of leadership. at every level of the world system, political, economic, military, social, even religious. A crisis of leadership. Our leadership is no longer serving us. Now, with Mr. Obama in the office, I feel great hope because this guy, you know, this guy has all of his ducks in a row. He's an extraordinarily smart guy, an extraordinarily intelligent guy. He's already thinking 10 steps ahead in the game of chess. But the question is, can he work with a dysfunctional Congress and Senate? And this is a big problem because, you see, it's not Obama's job to run the country. Obama's job is to lead the country. It's the Senate, the Congress's job to run the country. And they've been doing a very poor job for the last 8 years. So it's really time to get off the pot and just sort of produce the goods and do what needs to be done. And so we've got a charismatic leader who is, you know, very much, I mean, he's just right on the mark. He's just right on the mark. And so there may be a few stumbles. So what? He's going in the right direction. He's going in the right direction. And so this is part of the rectification of this crisis of leadership that we've had. Now, the financial world, you know, we could talk about that, but we don't have to because everybody knows, you know. They've been pillaging and plundering like pirates. You know, Tom Friedman had an article in the New York Times today called In the Age of Pirates or In the Time of Piracy. He's one of my favorites. Him and Maureen Dowd. Maureen Dowd is just fabulous.
Oh, I like her. She's great. She calls it. But you know what's interesting? And look how symbolic that is. We live in such a metaphoric, you know, world. You just said in the age of pirates, and we literally have had a resurgence of piracy on the Somali coast.
What's going on in Wall Street?
And exactly. And it's just, that is such an outpicturing of the consciousness, what's been going on. You've got, you know, when I was watching it on, I don't know, CNN, whatever, I was channel switching, and I thought, wait a minute, my God, are we back in the Barbary Coast times? What, are they pirates?
I know.
2009?
Do you remember a wonderful film called The Lion in Winter? It was with Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
Peter O'Toole was playing Henry II, the King of England, and Katharine Hepburn was playing Eleanor of Aquitaine. Both of these individuals are my ancestors on my father's mother's side, interestingly. So I watched that film periodically, you know, with a good deal of familial, you know, sort of...
Okay.
That sort of thing. Well, there's this wonderful scene in that film where Eleanor of Aquitaine, as the whole psychodrama of the family is just kind of unraveling, and everybody's lurking behind these curtains, listening into what everybody else has said, and finally it just goes one step too far, and one of the sons, I forget which one it was, maybe it was John, comes running out, and he's got this dagger, and somebody else shouts, "Look out, he's got a knife!" And, you know, Katharine Hepburn, as Eleanor of Aquitaine, says, "Of course he's got a knife. We've all got knives. It's the 11th century, and we're all barbarians." You know, it's a wonderful moment. Well, you know, I've heard people say it in our own time. My God, here it is, the 21st century, and we're still barbarians.
Yeah.
So this is what I mean by we've come to the end of this cycle now, and it's a time for real reassessment of who we are, what we're doing here, what we want for ourselves and for the next seven generations. And, you know, this is a very good thing, I think.
Now, one question I have, I have a lot of them for you, Hank, but what I want to touch on right now, with your... You know, you're bridging the science and the spirituality, not only bridging it, but living it. And so from your scientific perspective as well as your, you know, training and initiation shamanically, what is your perspective on, and you touched on it a little bit, you know, the president is here to lead us, but we have this dysfunctional Congress. You know, I look at it as group dynamics and family dynamics. You know, you always have one aware, one or enlightened one at least in the family, but then they're saddled with the dysfunctional ones. How can this evolution take place when you literally, like, you are tied to the dysfunctional aspect?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and at the risk of offending any conservatives who are listening in today, you know, we could say that George Bush really elected Barack Obama because he was just... People have called him the worst president we've ever had. And he and his friends in the White House literally drove the country off a cliff. And, you know, now this entire mess that we're in is due to the dysfunctional policies of the Republicans. You know, and now they're all pissed off because they're not in power, and they're protesting because they lost power. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a reason that they lost power, you know, and this, I think, is going to continue as we go toward the next election 2 years from now, when a lot of the congressmen and senators will be up for re-election. I think it's really up to the votership now to look at the performance of their representatives. And if anybody is not contributing to the solutions of today's problems, they're part of the problem. And they should just vote these people out and get rid of them, because you know, we can no longer afford to have people in our leadership, in our political leadership, who cannot do the job right. We have to do it right now. And you know, fortunately, we've got a leader who's going to point that out to us again and again and again.
And again.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, the dysfunctional. You know, it gets us back to learning from the negative. It's in response to the darkness that we move away from it toward the light. And I think the answer to the problem of evil in the world is to really create its opposite. And we start with ourselves. You know, if you want to heal the world, if you want to heal the planet, if you want to heal the country, you start with yourself, and you heal yourself. And when you heal yourself, the country, the family, the society will respond. And when this happens to tens of millions of people, at once, you know, things are going to change. There's just no way they're not going to.
Now, again, as a scientist, okay, because you see these cycles, you've been studying these cycles of man, especially as an archaeologist. Do you see that there's an improvement, or does it seem to get to a certain level? Because I've heard people say that we're just and I hope not, but you know, I'm a Pollyanna, I guess, that we get to that each. That we get to, in other words, there might be other times, but we get to the same level or the same point. I mean, do you see that in your research, or do you see differently?
I do. You know, it harks back to what you said a little bit earlier, that, you know, people have observed that we are the Romans of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And we are. I mean, if you look at our last president, you wonder which emperor, which dysfunctional emperor.
Yeah.
Was coming back for another round to see if he could get it right this time. And, of course, he didn't. You know, I don't know which one. You know, people have suggested that Nero would be a good candidate who fiddled while Rome burned. You know, this, you know.
Read the book.
Nero was not a good guy. I mean, this guy was a profoundly weird person. You know, if you read what this guy was really like. I mean, he just was completely out of touch with what was really going on. And the same thing could be observed of our last president. To a large degree, he was completely out of touch with what was really going on. And this is what allowed things to go as far as they did. Now, you know, the crisis of leadership, this must be shifted because, you know, we're really dependent upon our leadership now to make the correct decisions in this time of crisis and bring us through it and out of it and out the other side. And this is part and parcel of what the Romans were faced with. Unfortunately, they failed because the center collapsed. And so what it left was the Roman Empire sort of spread out all over the old world, all of which developed into separate states. It were the tax collectors, for example, who became the chiefs and set themselves up as local chieftains and kings. And it was the beginning of the Middle Ages. You know, when the center was gone, there was nothing to hold the whole thing together. You know, it's been observed that, you know, we are very much the same way. We've got military all over the world. I think somebody observed that we've got military in something like, you know, between 50 and 100 countries all over the world. It's like the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans were exactly the same way. And the cost of our military budget is bankrupting us. You know, the fact that the Defense Department gets 40% of our gross national annual budget, there's something not right there. There's something out of control. You know, we can't really afford to do that anymore. This is why communism failed in Russia. They couldn't afford their military anymore and the military budget. And so the whole system collapsed. It wasn't capitalism that triumphed over communism. It was that communism failed economically because it couldn't provide for their people. The military was costing them just much too much. And we're faced with the same problems today. Now, on the spiritual front, this turning toward the higher level of self, the God self, the one who's monitoring us, 24/7. You know, it's one of the things we explore in our shamanic workshops. We explore the nature of our connection with our higher self. Jill and I just finished a workshop at the Esalen Institute on Friday. We've just come back to the island after almost 4 weeks on the road. And it was a wonderful group. It was a very advanced group. And we were exploring the nature of our connection with our oversoul on the one hand and with our guide on the other. Now, folks in the transformational community use the word guide very freely, but a lot of people don't know who the guide really is. The guide really is the keeper of our oversoul. It's our oversoul's teacher. Guides are master teachers and figures of grace who are involved with our own personal soul's evolution as it travels across eternity. And more people in the Western world are turning their attention in this direction because it's providing us with an enormously enhanced understanding of who we are and what our support system really is, and the fact that, in the end, each one of us is really our own best teacher. And the oversoul, constantly monitoring, the guide constantly monitoring, they don't judge, as you pointed out earlier in your phone conversation with the lady who was on the line. They don't judge. This is not a punitive system. They silently applaud when we succeed, and they silently feel concern when we fail. But they can also manifest effects into this world, and often they'll do that by planting ideas in our minds or by bringing us into connection with just the right person, going to just the right talk or seminar or workshop or conference where we are brought into connection with it, some sort of transformational speaker of some sort who reveals a greater depth of who we are to ourselves and gets us thinking in new directions. I think this is really the great value of the transformational teachers right now. Their job is to help us gain a higher level of understanding of who we are and also to bring us into connection with these transpersonal forces that shamans call helping spirits and spirit teachers, because once you're in touch with these transpersonal others who have nothing but the best intentions for you, it's hard to go too far wrong after that, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. Now, do you find that when you touched on a little bit this, the new religion, do you feel that a big part of that is for people to learn how to tap in or get in contact with this part of themselves?
Absolutely. And it's extraordinarily easy to do. Prayer is one way. Prayer is one of the methods by which we talk to the gods. And you'll notice I used a plural word than just God. If you're talking to God, you're talking to your own personal God self. That's the one who listens to your prayers, not some monotheistic father figure sitting in heaven who has good days and bad days. That's largely mythology. But the one who monitors us, is the higher self. And they want only the best for us, but sometimes they have to watch us go through some fairly heavy stuff in order to learn our lessons, because that, in a sense, is what we all signed up for. This was also part and parcel of what we examined in the workshop last week. We examined the nature of our relationship with what I sometimes call, tongue-in-cheek, my cosmic committee. This is something I learned through shamanic journey work, that each one of us has a council of elder spirits in the upper worlds. The upper worlds are analogous to what people call heaven or paradise. And when we come out of life and we resume connection with our oversoul field in the afterlife, at some point our guide, all right, our master teacher, takes us to our council of elders. And they essentially debrief us about the life which has just been led. Their job is not to judge us. In fact, they may ask us questions and ask us to comment on how well we did with the life we've just completed, how well we did with learning our life lessons. These are the guys who have your cosmic contract. These are the guys.
Someone's putting in the chat. They want about if you could touch on the contracts. We have a question in the chat about that. If you can touch on those, the contracts.
Well, you know, before we come in back into life once again, we go before the council once again. And they're the ones who help us make decisions about which life to go into, the life through which we can help others as well as learn our lessons most effectively. And often we choose very challenging lives because the greater the challenges, the more rapid the growth. Now, this may seem strange to people who are just up to their nostrils in trouble right now, but the fact is that it's what we all signed up for, and it's in response to those lessons that we grow, that we increase, and we become more than we were. So the Cosmic Council, in a sense, they're the ones who help us determine which life we're going to step into for another action-packed round of life on the physical plane. And that really represents a kind of contract. And the council knows what's written on your contract. So one of the things that we did at the Esalen Institute last week is we took people through the shamanic journey work process to go and visit with their council to see what's on their contract. Now, can you renegotiate the contract?
Yeah.
Well, that's determined by your relationship with your council.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something I can advise at all. That's something you have to work with these master teachers. And these council members seem to represent the last level of hierarchy, I guess you could say, or authority,
yeah,
responsible for souls that are still incarnating on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to represent the highest level of authority. In other words, they only want the best for us. And so their
mm-hmm.
job is to infuse us with heart, with encouragement, by foreseeing great things for us. And that's their job. That's what they inevitably do. And then we come back here and slog it out for another 70 or 80 years, you know, getting through our stuff. And then, you know, when we're over it and we're in spirit once again, whew, what a ride, you know. We go back,
mm-hmm.
we merge the oversoul field, the higher self, and then at some point we are taken back to the Cosmic Council, who look at us with great amusement and encouragement and say, well, how'd you do this time? This is what the relationship with the Cosmic Council is like.
Yeah. Now, Hank, when we're that contract, what form are we in? Because we're not in the space of formlessness when that contract. Is it other dimensional? Is it planetary when we're coming back in and signing this contract? Or is it an energetic contract, a geometrical or mathematical equation of what we're to do?
It's a good question. It's a good question. I could ask you the same question.
I know. Well, I can remember only so far back, so that's what I'm asking you.
Well, that's what makes it all interesting, isn't it? I mean, when
yeah.
we come back in from spirit into form, we come mm-hmm. back in from the realm of things hidden into the realm of things seen, and we go through the veil, and that gives us a fresh start in each lifetime. In other words, a life which is not being determined by the sorrows and pains and successes of the past. So we develop a new sense of self in each lifetime. And this is what makes it all very interesting, doesn't it? So
yeah.
when you go before
yeah.
your cosmic committee, this is a purely subjective, energetic state in
mm-hmm.
which these committee members could be thought of, I think of them as organizing intelligences.
Mm.
Organizing intelligences, because when you're in the other world, when you're in the dimensions of things hidden, and that's what I do as a shamanic practitioner, and that's what I do with my workshops, I help people develop this ability to go into these transpersonal realms in a focused, goal-oriented way so that they can experience the spirit world themselves and find connection with these transpersonal beings who are there to be of service to them. And the Cosmic Committee is kind of like the highest level. This was actually a very advanced workshop, sort of the third level of the workshops that we teach. So it's a purely subjective state, and while we're there in the presence of these organizing intelligences, it's almost like you get this sense of beauty and harmony and peace, and that everything has been ordered absolutely exquisitely, and it's been organized by these higher intelligences to be a very specific way. This is what, you know, people call heaven. Most of us only get glimpses of it when we're here embodied in life because, you know, it's not what we're here to do. We're here to actually experience this world and to respond to it and to grow in response to it. But when you're in the other world, the predominant emotional field is love. You know, the spirit world, as you pointed out, is not a punitive place. There is no place of pain and suffering called hell. Those realms exist here, and they exist only for those people who dream them for themselves. Yeah. Mm. Now, does that mean that the hell realms are purely mythological? Unfortunately, it does not, because when we cross over and we find ourselves in what the Tibetan Buddhists call the Bardo realms, those of your listeners who've read the Tibetan Book of Death or Dead and Dying are aware of the fact that there exist these dreamlike afterlives, that they don't last for very long, but we usually go into them when we make transition, and they are dreamed by the discarnate soul for themselves. So if you believe you're going to Mount Meru, you've been a good Buddhist, that's where you go. If you believe you're going to heaven, you know, because you've been a good Catholic or a good Methodist, that's where you go. But if you're, you know, going through kicking and screaming, terribly afraid because you've been an absolute pirate during life and you've done a lot of bad things, you may actually dream a very bad dream for yourself and be face-to-face with these Bardo demons that Hieronymus Bosch painted in his extraordinary paintings about 500-600 years ago during the Renaissance. You know, these realms exist, but they're determined by the dreamer,
by our belief, and that's us,
to a large degree. Yeah. This is why it's very important when people are passing that they go through the veil back into the spirit world in a very peaceful, harmonious, and enthusiastic way, looking forward to what's coming up. You know, in traditional societies, it was always the job of the shaman to prepare people for death. In our society, our priests have largely lost track of this. Very few of them can actually track discarnate souls and help them to go where they're supposed to go in the afterlife. But this is one of the jobs of the shaman. And there are people involved in the new shamanic community who are very gifted at being able to do this.
The conversation
is taking us in interesting directions. I'm just kind of flowing with it here.
Oh, I love it. Are you kidding?
I hope it's in tune with what, you're thinking about as well.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because whatever is spoken is needed right here, right now. So everyone online and everyone in the chat and listening, that's going to be listening to the archive after this, needs to hear this. Because I think you're answering some questions that a lot of people, I think, in the stage of awakening are asking. You know, like when we talked about the contracts as well as the ego. To me, these are some things that questions for people, but also pitfalls. There's a lot of talk of, oh, we're just repeating, or we're just like the Romans, or the same thing that happened to the Romans is going to happen to us. There's a lot of this information out bombarding people, and I think to have another viewpoint, you know, something else to refer to.
Well, you know, three very interesting things. First of all, we are like the Romans, but, you know, life is like a spiral. And it can maintain its stability for a very long time, but it can change very rapidly when energy flows into the spiral or out of the spiral. And the spiral is not flat, it ascends. So, for example, we still have gladiatorial games today to distract the public, but we don't kill the gladiators anymore.
No.
That's a step up, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, but that's very profound what you said, the spiral ascends. See, because I think what you're speaking and what you're noticing, you know, perhaps because, you know, with the scientific aspect or perception, as well as the spiritual, is like you're saying, yes, we are like the Romans, we do that, but, you know, like you said, we don't kill the gladiator, and also saying that the spiral ascends. So for people to keep in mind, Hank, that we are ascending, it's getting better and better or more ideal. I think somehow many people are losing sight of that. They feel that we're replaying exactly in the same old way what was replayed before.
Well, we didn't get it right the last time, did we? We're having to repeat. I mean, I remember.
But is it exact? I guess what I'm asking is, do you see it as we're repeating the same, or we're repeating something similar in a different way?
Well, it's something similar, but we've stepped up.
Okay,
we're doing it better this time. You know, like football players and basketball players and baseball players, they're essentially gladiators. And, you know, the Romans used gladiatorial games to distract the public and to keep the public from realizing that the whole empire was going down the tubes. As long as people were given their gladiatorial games, sometimes 150 days in a row, you know, people were not paying attention to what was going on. And that was part of the purpose of these gladiatorial games. You know, the same thing is true in our society. You know, without offending any great sports fans out there, you know, the chances are that we're going to be subjected to endless, meaningless sporting events on television from now until eternity, because this is one of the things that distracts us. Now, this brings up two very interesting archetypes, and I don't know if you want to go this direction or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, people, you mentioned the devil a few moments ago. I don't know how many of your listeners out there are aware of it, but the devil and Satan are actually two different people, two different archetypes. Interestingly, neither one of these beings has anything to do with the archetype of evil. They're both angels who took on a very specific job in order to be of service to humanity. Now, the devil, that's Lucifer, all right?
It's the light bearer.
Lucifer, the light bearer. Does that sound like a bad guy to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Holds the light.
Yeah, Lucifer is the one who stepped down from these higher realms to bring light to those who sat in darkness. And he does it through a very interesting way. Lucifer is the master of desire. Okay?
Mm.
When, I'll sort of conjure up a meaningless example here. Let's say you come home, you know, and you've had a few drinks, and you take one look at the babysitter and make a pass at the babysitter because she's just so gorgeous. That's a luciferic impulse. That's desire.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And desire, you know, the desire for things, the desire for clothes, the desire to shop, the desire for lovers, you know, the desire for power and prestige and money. This is all within the realm of Lucifer. Lucifer is the master of desire. But Satan is quite a different person, quite a different individual. You know, if we trace these individuals back through the myths, Satan is actually God's shadow. And I'm talking about the good God, the creator God. You know, it's the shadow side of the creative force who was envisaged by the Sumerians 5,000 years ago as a god they called Enlil, E-N-L-I-L, whose shadow was Enki, E-N-K-I. This was the duality, the good God and the shadow God. And the shadow God, the good God eventually became Jehovah or Yahweh or God or Allah, the way we perceive the creator God today. He was known as Marduk among the Babylonians and so forth and so on. The shadow God became Ahriman among the Zoroastrians, among the Persians. And among the Judeo-Christians, he became known as Satan. Now, Satan is the master of illusion. Satan is the one who weaves illusions that ensnare us and captivate us so that we never find out who we are, what we're doing here, and what this is all about. And I remember when I was still living in Sacramento, when I was still teaching college there, in the summertime, I used to take walks in the evening around 8:30, 9 o'clock at night to get some exercise, and there'd be nobody on the street. Everybody would be sitting in their living rooms staring at this box, all right, and this blue light would be coming out of the side of the box. Nobody would be talking, nobody would be singing, nobody would be telling stories. They'd all be eating mindlessly, staring at this box, saying nothing. And, of course, you know what the box is.
It's TV, right? Oh,
right. When you come home at the end of the day and you turn on your television set, you know, and you have your ritual glass of wine or martini or whatever, what appears on the screen? An illusion.
Yeah.
That's him. And the entire media, the entire entertainment industry, that's the master of illusion. That's Satan. That's who Satan really is. And his job is to distract us.
Distraction.
So
now, let me ask
who we are.
Now, let me ask, because what you're saying, when I'm hearing that the Satan I think of in the tarot, the magician, because you have different levels of that magician or, you know, indigenous-wise, the trickster, astrologically Pisces, which works with illusion, and which works with the television, film industry, anything that distracts us. Is there a, I hate to say positive, but in a sense, a life-enhancing approach to that, to some of that illusion?
Of course, because eventually you reach a point where you realize it for what it is, and you turn the television off. And the minute you do that, you've passed the test. You've passed the test.
Whoa,
you're no
okay, wait. Let's back up. So are we meant to get beyond that illusion? So in other words, that...
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's what the test is all about. How do you distinguish between reality and illusion?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a major problem. This is a major problem because the entertainment industry and the media has more power than the President of the United States.
Yeah.
They're very much in control. You know, I always had this fantasy, Michelle, about being interviewed by somebody like Barbara Walters. And after she did to me what she does to everybody on her show, I would sort of lean in and sort of tell her what I've just told you. And then I would finish up by looking at her and saying, tell me, Barbara, how does it feel to be working for the master of illusion? Because that's who signs your paycheck.
Oh, you'd freak her out.
Yeah.
This is
a realization.
Yeah.
As to who Satan really is.
Wow.
And, you know, the Old Testament version of Satan is just no longer serving us. I mean, this is why we need an upgrade. We need to see these guys for who they really are. Now, the archetype of evil has nothing to do with Satan or the devil.
Right.
Right. They do their job. You know, the archetype of evil, you know, we don't really have to go in this direction because all of us know that it exists. And we've seen it in action. We see it in action every day. This was humanity's true sin. This is where we really fell from grace. Because humanity created evil. It didn't exist before we created it. And now that we've created it, it's like the genie is out of the bottle. And there's no getting the genie back in. So the only answer to the archetype of evil is to create its opposite, until it eventually is so neutralized by the light that the darkness just ceases to exist.
Now, when you
say
evil,
it's going to take a long time. Yes?
My interpretation is misuse of power. How are you looking at evil? How are you characterizing evil?
Well, what would you call waterboarding, for example, or torture?
Oh, misuse of power. I mean, I don't know. Those things are so icky. I don't even have a word for it, really, I guess. I have a visceral response to it.
Yeah. It's the intentional infliction of pain and suffering on others.
Ooh, wow.
That's evil.
That's evil. Wow.
That's evil. And anybody who goes in that direction is working with that archetype of evil. And in the process, they're corrupted and they become evil themselves.
Now, do you feel this is a component of human nature? A lot of people say this is a component of human nature, this aspect.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, you do see mental illness among animals, don't you? I mean, one of the great revelations of Jane Goodall's work with the chimpanzees in Africa, you know, we used to have this idyllic idea of chimpanzees as being a beautiful... forest-living, fruit-eating vegetarians who live this idyllic life swinging through the trees and so on and so on. What was revealed is that these chimpanzees can be real bad guys. You know, they wreak warfare on each other the way humans do, where all the males will get together. All the males will get together, and they'll go and they'll track down another group, and they will literally intentionally kill the other males of the group. I mean, it's nothing more or less than systematic warfare. We've seen mental illness among chimpanzees where there'll be one, there was a very famous chimpanzee whose name I can't remember right now, but it was a female, and she intentionally killed and ate something like 17 infants, where she and one of her children would intentionally separate a female from their child, kill the child, and then eat it. Now, it can only be described as mental illness. So it does exist. It's part of the distortion that exists in the animal world, and it's inevitably part of this animal body that we inhabit, you know, this tendency towards the dark side. And, you know, that's where the challenge is. That's where the choices are made. And if we choose wrongly, we're just going to be given more chances to choose rightly further down the line. But it's all about choice, isn't it, in the end?
Yes.
And choice is a function of the ego. That's why we develop the ego.
We're evolving the ego.
Absolutely. That's what we're here to do. We're
here to develop
the ego, not drop it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're on the same page when it comes to the ego, Michelle.
I know. I love that. I love that. Well, you know what? Earlier on my path, when one of my teachers, I actually had to develop an ego. It was too egoless, and he said for doing the going further in this work or you know grounding anything or manifesting, you need an ego. You're too merging. You're too mergy, wishy washy. You know you need to develop an ego. So, you know, I'm sure I had somewhat of one, but you know, looking back, I could see how that and you know the idea is not to escape, you know, to merge with everything and just disappear, you know. It's to step forward in our truth, right?
We need this highly developed inner warrior to successfully track our life through, you know, its cycle this time around. In my own case, I was this nice, shy Hank guy until my first divorce. Well, I only had one divorce, but it was the divorce of my starter marriage. And my ex-wife suffered from some fairly profound emotional problems, and one of these involved just demonizing me and creating this monster and essentially going around and deep-sixing all of my friendships, even tried to work on my family to abandon me. And so finally, that was it, you know. When she started to work on my family, I thought, all right, you want a monster? Now I'm going to give you a monster.
Yeah.
And I developed my inner warrior in response to this challenge. And that was the end of the game. The minute my inner warrior came out, it was over.
Mm.
It was over. But if I hadn't had that life experience, would I have developed that inner warrior? Hard to say. You know, it might have just come in another way. Mm. But, you know, that's
was what was needed. That was that piece that brought that out of you. You know, that...
Yeah. You know, I developed my inner server by being a servant to my children.
Mm.
You know, when my children were little, I was literally a servant to my children. When I went to art school, I developed my inner artist, my inner creator. I'm a scholar. That's my primary life role. I'm a scholar, and so it's all about assimilation of large amounts of information. And I'm just constantly reading, trying to figure it all out. And, you know, trying to gain illumined understanding through the experience of authentic knowledge. It's very different from theory. You know, theory is kind of like the negative polarity. And knowledge is like the positive polarity. And then as a teacher, I would stand in front of my classes in these universities and colleges, and I would express the knowledge that I contained and weave it together to create wisdom for my students. You know, this is where I found my, I guess you could call it my inner sage, my inner sage. I do that in workshops now, you know, in places like Omega and Esalen and, you know, other places around the country. And, you know, in these workshops, I might add, we also inevitably have a transpersonal healing ritual, a shamanic healing ritual on Thursday evening, in which we bring in our spirit helpers and teachers and function as healers on behalf of somebody in the group who has a serious life-threatening issue, you know, something nice like cancer or lupus or Crohn's disease. I mean, you know, one of those nice light afflictions like that. The amazing thing is that people respond very positively to these healing rituals, and they get better. You know, the cancer goes away, the lupus goes away, the Crohn's disease goes away. And these are not easy afflictions to cure. Well, for the healer, you know, we're working at the level of the priest or the priestess, whose positive polarity is compassion and whose negative polarity is zeal. This is all kahuna stuff I'm talking to you about from my friend the kahuna here in Hawaii. You know, he talked about this a lot. But inevitably, each one of us is going towards the life role which is involved with developing our own inner chief, our own inner king or queen. And for the inner king, the inner queen, the inner chief, the inner director or CEO, this is your egoic self now we're talking about. You know,
right.
The positive polarity is being of service. It brings us back to the level of the servant. an authentic chief is of service to their people. You know, it's about mastery. It's about self-mastery. The negative polarity of the dysfunctional chief is tyranny. It's about do it my way or else.
Which
it's
got
my
out
way
of
or
that.
The highway. That's the negative polarity.
So are we moving more individually and collectively into that service model of being of service and out of tyranny? Do you feel, I feel like we kind of, I hope, we went to the max on that.
It certainly is true in our political leadership, isn't it? I mean, if you look at our man in the White House and his wife these days, these people are beautiful examples of the authentically initiated chief. No, Obama's a chief. He's an authentic chief who is, he's a master of himself. It's like when that reporter asked him at the press conference, well, for 2 days, blah, 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 how come you didn't say anything? And Obama just gave him this very stern look and said, because I wanted to be well-informed before I opened my mouth. I mean, that was a marvelous moment. You know, next question. And the reporter just kind of slunk down in his seat having done that because it was so obvious. You know, Obama's a chief, and I feel great. I feel hope for the future with this kind of leadership because it's going to bring the best out of all of us. But, of course, each one of us has a choice, don't we?
Well, it's almost like it's an extending out of that archetypal energy, and do we take a bit of that, you know, as the archetype when we, right? Do we imbibe some of that and bring that into our own personal life, which then affects everyone around us? That's it. We're getting a lesson in a sense in leadership if we take that.
Absolutely.
You know, and I always say it's not the man, but what they're saying, right? It's that energy of.
That's right. He's embodying a certain archetype, and that has the power to help us embody that archetype as well. But it's all about choice in the end. Are we going to choose it or not? But if we do choose it, we will become better people, and our lives will become more interesting, and our problems will become less, and they'll become clearer, and they'll become more surmountable. And really, that's what it's all about. It's about developing that inner CEO, that inner chief, an authentically initiated chief. And we're all going in that direction. It's just a question of when we're going to get there.
So we're all going in that direction, maybe not exactly at the same time. But what I'm hearing you say is that, anyway, that's a bigger part of the evolution. So eventually we'll all be there.
Sure. You know, when I was growing up, when I was a teenager and I was even a student in college, I was really this kind of shy guy. And the thought of standing up in front of a class of 100 students or in front of a conference of 1,000 people and holding forth, you know, speaking before a group, you know, I never could have picked that in a million years. And yet I ended up doing that. I ended up doing that. I ended up embodying and embracing that to be of service. It's like you and your radio show. You're being of service to untold numbers of listeners. You are functioning in a very important way as a chief, serving the community by bringing people like myself and your other speakers and members of the community together to discuss really important issues, to give a voice to the problems that we face in our time, to look for those solutions. I mean, this is an extraordinarily important role that you're doing. You're doing it through the media on the one hand. You're actually using the power of the master of illusion to you know, create this, and this is a wonderful thing. And you know,
I guess, and that brings back just in our remaining minutes. So what I'm hearing, there is a positive way to use that focus of illusion, that Satan magician. Okay.
Everything has a positive polarity and a negative polarity.
So it's how one is using that energy, that Lucifer energy of desire, going for what you desire, or the illusion energy.
It's about choosing and choosing again and making the right choices, isn't it? Because there's nothing wrong with desire. Desire is what brings us into connection with that which we seek. But what is it that we seek? You know, can we make different choices? Is it about, you know, mindlessly eating until you weigh 300 or 400 pounds? Or is it about, you know, taking that power of desire and channeling it into a more wholesome direction? Mm-hmm. So is it about shopping till you drop? Is it about emerging from Nordstrom's as the champion because you've got more bags of stuff on your arm than anybody else?
Yeah.
Is that what it's really about? You know, of course, this is what the merchants want us to do.
Yeah.
And they took
power
during the Renaissance. You know, the guilds were the infrastructure of the world corporate state. And they've been running the show ever since. You know, business rules. Business rules. What's good for business is good for the country, is good for the government, is good for us. But, you know, maybe not necessarily. Maybe people are going to make different choices now. That doesn't
sound like
business is bad, but it has to change.
No. Yeah. Yeah, but it sounds like what I'm hearing from you, it's about the balance, is that we have to rebalance. What are we desiring? Right? Yeah. What are we desiring and what are we using? Yeah, the illusion. What are we getting caught up in? Or are we using this film or television or radio? Are we using that to empower or to enslave or ensnare? It almost sounds like when I'm listening to you, Hank, that it's in a sense there's a part of it, I want to say grassroots, but even more, it seems like a subconscious to subliminal to just slightly under the surface revolution that's taking place, where there's perhaps a refinement of these areas that you're talking about.
It is. And, you know, what that means, Michelle, is that you and I are spiritual revolutionaries.
Hmm.
You know,
wow.
I remember years ago I was at a prophets conference up in Victoria, British Columbia, and at the end of the conference there was a private party for all the presenters. And we had Barbara Marx Hubbard, we had Greg Braden, we had Houston Smith, we had the Redfields who created the Celestine Prophecy, we had Brooke Medicine Eagle, had all sorts of interesting people there. And I was there with my wife, Jill. And at one point I looked around this room and it suddenly struck me. And the producer of the event, Cody Johnson, came up to me and said, "How you doing, Hank?" And I'd had several glasses of wine at that point, and I'd been out on the porch having a smoke with Tom Robbins, the author, very entertaining man, you know. So I looked around the room and I said, "Cody, you see all the people here in this room?" And he says, "Yeah." And I said, "Cody, this is a gathering of revolutionaries." And he didn't miss a beat. He looked at me and he said, "Yeah, and there's nobody to nail to the cross this time."
There's too many.
Millions of us. There's millions of us. There are tens of millions of us. You know, there was a book that was written by Paul Ray and his wife Sherry Ruth Anderson called The Cultural Creatives. He revealed that in 2000, which is almost 10 years ago, there were 50 million of us in the United States alone, with another 70 to 80 million in Europe. And, of course, this is 10 years later. It's probably closer to 70 to 80 million now, with another 100 million in Europe. I mean, these are not small numbers, and they appear to be growing. This is the size of the transformational community.
Wow.
And one of the things that I think is so important for people to realize is that we are traveling in the company of an enormous number of allies who think like we do, who have values like we do, who believe in the existence of energetic fields and spirit helpers and spirit teachers and the ability of people to go in and interact with these transpersonal forces directly themselves. I mean, they have a whole complex of belief systems which differ from those of the general public. And, you know, they are emergent now. They are emerging. You know, the views, the more evolved views of the secular humanists who perceive an omnipresent, user-friendly power or force which is found in everything, everywhere, essentially a pantheistic perspective, which means that God is in everything.
Everything.
That we are manifestations of God ourselves. And therefore, it's up to us to really try to behave a little more like God-like beings, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's
about. We are those cultural creatives.
We are.
And we're shifting. We're in the paradigm shift.
We always have great conversations on your show, Michelle.
I know. We do. We'll have to do it again, Hank. Oh, gosh. Now, one thing, I'm going to be putting your website in the chat, but those that are listening in other means, radio only, I want to let you know that you can connect with Hank Wesselman at his website, sharedwisdom.com, and find out about any upcoming you know, workshops or events, some of these wonderful workshops and healings that he facilitates. And also, I want to just touch, before we close, Hank, on a few of your books, and just also ask you, if someone is newly embarking on the path or perhaps at a stage of emergence, which one you feel would be assisting, obviously all of them, but one that calls you?
Well, we have two small books. The first one was called The Journey to the Sacred Garden,
okay,
which you can read in 2 hours. And it's got a CD in it for journey work,
okay,
of my drum and my rattle. The Journey to the Sacred Garden. And the second book is a complement to that one. It's a book called Spirit Medicine, and it's really a guide to shamanic healing. I co-wrote it with my wife, Jill. She wrote the chapters on soul loss and soul retrieval. Yeah.
And Jill is going to be on the show, by the way.
Oh, what
May,
day?
I believe the beginning of May. I believe it's the beginning of May. So if you want to call in and join, you're welcome to. Let me see.
She'll be on. You know, you're going to enjoy her. Jill is a chief.
Friday.
And
she's
also a very powerful transpersonal healer who works with restoring the fabric of people's souls who've been damaged by life.
Yeah, I want to let people
work,
know.
No.
Yeah, Jill, who also happens to be, but not just, Hank Wesselman's wife, but Jill will be on Friday, May 1st at 12 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here on Awakenings. I'm really looking forward to it because, as she works with transpersonal energies, is a facilitator of soul retrieval, so it'll be just amazing. So those of you that are listening or in the chat, mark that down. That'll be Friday, May 1st at 12 p.m. Pacific here on Awakenings. Good. So just to kind of touch back on this, the two books that you're talking about, Hank, are The Journey to the Sacred Garden and then also Spirit Medicine.
Yeah. And then, of course, if people want a real mind-blowing read, read Spirit Walker, because this book has been published in 13 languages. It's in its, like, 14th or 15th printing. It's the book of how I went crazy in Hawaii back in the 1980s and how I began to have these transpersonal experiences in which my mind was brought into connection with the mind of another man who lives in the future. In fact, he is probably one of my descendants, one of my descendant selves, and he and I are both sourced by the same oversoul. In other words, he is me living a future life and a future's length of time. It's an extraordinary book, and the book received a tremendous amount of press back when it was first released in 1995, and it brought me into connection with the transformational community. It brought me out of the ivory tower and into the public arena, which I've just had nothing but fun with ever since. I mean, I've really enjoyed doing this kind of thing, like talking with you on the radio.
I love it. And the reason I asked which book is because I got last time emails, you have so many books, which one would be good? You know, and I'm just, some people, you know, we have a very diverse listener base and chat participant base. Some people have been walking the path consciously for a very long time, and those people may immediately go to Spirit Walker or your Medicine Maker or Spirit Medicine. They may go right to those books. And then those that are just kind of saying, what is Hank talking about? I resonate with that. But those people, I would say, The Journey to the Sacred Garden or Spirit Medicine.
Very easy reads.
Mm-hmm.
They're very easy reads. The Spirit Walker trilogy, it's actually a trilogy. The first book is called Spirit Walker. The second is called Medicine Maker. And the third is called Vision Seeker. And people tend to love this trilogy. People have likened it to Lord of the Rings. And many people have said it would make an extraordinary film if we could get somebody like Peter Jackson to do it. You know,
let's put that out there.
Maybe I should send him
a copy. Why don't you?
Yeah.
Well, you got to lose. And I'm trying to think of the guy from Elevate, also Film Festival. They're starting to fund films. So
yeah.
I would, because we need these forms, which is what the Oversouls have been saying. We need new forms that reflect the new expanded consciousness. So the movies, we need movies that are reflecting this and also helping people that are having that a spiritual emergence or emergency, you know, to read a book like Spirit Walker or to or to see it on the screen and say, oh my God, that's what's happening to me. Oh my God, okay, this is what's going on.
Well, I'm still getting
okay,
on these
okay, with me for the next time, huh?
Okay, Michelle, well, blessings on you.
Blessings to you. And no, I'm just saying, okay, I hope send something out. And I'm going to put my, because I think these would make a great film, you know, or films. So maybe we'll just put some energy to that, to putting it out there, and even, like you said, sending it to him. Because, yeah, I think it would be amazing. And the time is right.
Yeah, I'd love to get Jennifer Connelly to play Jill.
Ooh, yeah.
And then I'd love to get Johnny Depp to play me.
Ooh.
That
he'd
be cool.
So into something like this.
Oh, well, he might,
so yeah.
But I'm going to warn your listenership, there's a lot of sex in these books, so be prepared.
Sacred Tantra.
Sacred
it's all
tantra.
Good, right? Okay.
It's all good.
Where we came from. Well, this has been good and better. So wonderfully, again, to connect with you. Just
okay,
absolutely.
Michelle.
So much insight and wisdom. Thanks so much, Hank. And thanks for going a little over. Really appreciate it. And again, open door policy. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
Okay. Thanks for having me. Aloha.
Aloha. And aloha to all of you wonderful participants in the sacred space of empowerment, also known as the chat room. Amber, thank you for calling in, Evolution Muse. I see Reiki, all of you, just really thanks for holding the space and making awakenings what it is, part of the converging flow. As Hank was saying, we're all coming from all walks of life. We really are being supported in all this, and we are all coming together. We have been speaking with Hank Wesselman. If you'd like more information or to contact Hank, you can go to his website, which is sacredwisdom.com. You can find out about some of his amazing workshops, seminars, personal work. You can find out about what he has going on. And again, that website is sharedwisdom.com. And you have been listening to Awakenings. Until next time, keep awake. Remember, I may live that life. Enjoy it.